Thank you for joining us for another podcast from the Commonwealth Club of California.
Please welcome Ben Shapiro and Matt Shoup to the Inforum stage.
All right, is this on? Sounds like it. Man, I almost wish that they would introduce me. Hi, I'm Matt Shoup, and I'm obviously the most known person on the stage. Just kidding. None of you know who I am, so give me a second to introduce myself. I'm Matt Shoup. I'm the managing partner of Praetorian Public Relations, a political consultant. I run campaigns for a living. I'm also the executive director of the California Young Republicans Federated. I'm thrilled to have Ben Shapiro here. At 17, Ben was the youngest nationally syndicated columnist in America as part of the Creator Syndicate. Earlier in his career, he was the editor-at-large for Breitbart.com. He is the co-founder of Truth Revolt, the media watchdog site, wrote several successful books, and started his own law practice. Today, he's the editor-in-chief of DailyWire.com and is the host of The Ben Shapiro Show, the number one conservative podcast on iTunes. So let's get started. So...
First of all, thank you all for your patience. I apologize on behalf of the airlines. Yeah, really. I wrote a piece this morning defending the airlines, and boy, do I feel terrible about that.
So today, there was a press conference regarding a lawsuit that was filed against UC Berkeley for suppressing the First Amendment rights of the Berkeley College Republicans and the Young Americans Foundation. This seems systemic almost in our culture now, where the left feels that they can aggressively and now violently suppress conservative speech on campus. So how do we fight it?
Well, I mean, I think that the way Ann is doing it is about the right way to do it. I mean, I did this also at Cal State Los Angeles. We had a similar situation where the administration tried to cancel the speech that I was giving at Cal State LA, and we told them to screw themselves. We were coming anyway. And then about an hour before that speech, they reversed themselves and they allowed me to speak, but it was a near riot. We ended up suing the university. So this has become relatively systemic. I won't say that it's true for all these colleges. I speak at 25 to 30 of them a year, but I'd say like, 3 or 4 a year are really bad. Obviously, I do wonder how much at Berkeley is the students and how much is Antifa.
Yeah.
Because I spoke at Berkeley like 2 years ago and it was no problem. And now Antifa is there making trouble. And it really is disgusting that the administration isn't working with the police to shut down Antifa. I mean, this is a violent group that is obviously violating the rights of people to hear free speech. And that's just, you can't have a rioters veto this way. It's really awful. Mm-hmm.
You know, one thing I actually found kind of interesting about it is that they're in violation of the Klan Act, which was developed to fight the KKK, and now the anti-fascist racists are the ones violating it. And so what are your thoughts on kind of the transition of now they call themselves anti-fascist, but a lot of us think that they are actually the fascists.
Well, I mean, the bottom line to me is whoever brings the gun to the party is the fascist. And these are the people who are bringing the club or the gun. So... But they have a generalized view of the world, which is that everybody who is conservative is a Nazi, and Nazis ought to be punched. So if you use that two-step logic, then everybody who is right-wing ought to be punched. There are two flaws to that. One, you shouldn't punch Nazis unless Nazis are physically threatening you. And two, not all right-wingers are Nazis, but they don't seem to see the connect.
So there's been obviously an escalation in willingness to do violence by these groups on campus and towards conservatives. How do we fight that escalation?
I mean, unfortunately, what you're seeing is you're starting to see groups that feel the necessity to show up and defend speakers, and I think that that's totally within their purview. I mean, I spoke on my podcast this week with a couple of people who showed up at another one of these free speech events in Berkeley, and one of these fights broke out, and it turned violent. If people aren't willing to stand up and defend their free speech, and the police are just going to stand by and do nothing, I don't see what choice people have other than to defend themselves. And I would love to see a situation... I would love to see a situation where none of this violence breaks out. I didn't used to have to bring bodyguards to my public events. I didn't used to have to bring security when I would speak on college campuses. Now, whenever I speak on a college campus, I have to bring 2 members of security, and we have to coordinate with the police beforehand. This is something that didn't exist 2 years ago, and I fear that it's only getting worse because there's a group of people who cheer this stuff. There's a group of people who feel like they've really done some sort of yeoman's work. Now, the irony of this, of course, is that there are certain people on the right who are provocateurs who are waiting for this, who really want this. Like, I'm happy to go speak to a crowd of people with no violence, just to have the discussion. I mean, I'm perfectly happy destroying people in debate, right? I don't actually have to do it physically. But what you see very often is that there are people on the right who are itching for this. And if the left understood that, they'd be much better off, because they're actually feeding into a lot of what is driving the popularity of certain political figures.
So where do you see this plateauing at a certain point? Where do you think this is going?
I mean, I do think that there will be a backlash at a certain point. I think that there's going to be liberals as opposed to people on the left, and I always make that distinction, who say enough is enough. I mean, you saw Bernie Sanders, of all people, come out and defend Anne's right to speak in Berkeley. I don't know in what alternative timeline, for some reason in the alternative timeline where Biff married Marty's mom. And everything is explained by this simple divergence in time, but in the time-space continuum. But yes, I mean, now I'm standing with Bernie Sanders and Bill Maher, because I think that this has gone so far that even folks on the left are beginning to look and say, this is a little bit crazy. We have to stop this.
You know, it's one thing when these speakers coming up, Milo and Ann, they swoop through Berkeley and they cause these incidents, but then the Berkeley College Republicans and all these conservative groups are kind of left there to go to class the next day and deal with their peers. How do you suggest to them they deal with this on a day-to-day basis?
You know, I'm not sure that on a day-to-day basis they're really dealing with it that much from their peers. I think that they're the brave ones, because you're right. I mean, I come, I speak, I leave, and they have to deal with the fallout. But the truth is, most people on college campuses don't care that much about politics. Like, this is the great lie of media coverage of politics on campus. The vast majority of college students are totally apathetic about this stuff. They want to smoke pot and drink and have sex and be left alone for the most part to babble back to the professors whatever they think the professors want to hear. Get the grades and leave. I mean, that's what most college students are there to do. So, you know, this idea that it's all, you know, people beating on each other for politics, I think there's a certain subsection of the campus that cares deeply about it, but I think it's a relatively small subsection. You know, going back to my days at UCLA, I'll say it for the rest of the YAF members, the College Republicans, I enjoyed the fight. I think that most people on the right sort of enjoy this. If you didn't enjoy it, then why do it? But, you know, I think that there are some notes that they should, you know, there's some notes they should take, such as don't mouth off to a professor if it means that you're going to sacrifice your grade. I differ from some other people on the right in saying this. I think that it's very foolish for conservatives to give the baton to people on the left who want to use their power to quash conservatives. Instead, get good grades, make lots of money, give donations to the school, and get the professor fired.
So do you see a long-term solution to almost the culture war that you see at university campuses, where they, you know, now that, you know, people think that they're indoctrinating these youth to be, you know, you talk a lot about, you know, the trans rights, you know, culture that's going on and stuff. Do you see us fighting that? Do you see us winning it? How does that happen?
Well, I mean, that's sort of a different kind of question than sort of the free speech argument to a certain extent, because that's where you see social liberals in conflict with certain basic concepts of free speech. Like, my view on transgenderism is that you can call yourself whatever you want, but the minute that you demand that I call you something, now you are imposing something on me, and that's not the way this works. So this is a bigger battle. But I do think that there's going to be sort of a libertarian agreement that arrives on campus where people say, listen, we'll all just leave each other alone, and that'll be it, and we can all go about our lives. I think that's going to happen in America more broadly, too, because I don't think this sort of tension can keep up. I think there will be a sort of conservative-libertarian merger on the right, where people on the right acknowledge that libertarians are basically right about government. Government sucks at everything, so let the government get out of it. And libertarians sort of acknowledge about conservatives that conservatives are right, that you have to have some sort of social fabric that exists largely because of religious communities and people who are willing to pick each other up, so the government doesn't have to do that. And I think that if you have that, then you have the makings for a broad agreement that it's possible for people to get behind. On campus, I think it's sort of similar. I think that the number one argument that seems to work when I speak on campuses to kids is just stopping a jackass. Like, why is it your business what I say? Why is it your business what I do? I'm not in your business. Why are you in mine? And I think that a lot of kids resonate to that, because they've always made those arguments to conservatives, right? That's the argument they've made to conservatives about sex and about drugs. And my view is, I don't care what you do sexually. I don't care what you do as far as drugs. I do care if you start trying to, you know, tell me I can't say certain things that I am certainly allowed to say and that are well within the mainstream of public opinion, by the way.
How does this translate into elections? Does this atmosphere that exists now, does this help Republicans? Does it hurt Republicans?
I mean, this helps Republicans. I mean, it's become cliche at this point to point to, you know, Antifa and say, this is why Trump. But this is why Trump. I mean, the fact is that Trump was a reactionary force. A lot of people looked at the left. They said they're awful, they're violent, they're over the top, And we're going to react to that by electing somebody who is not going to tell us that we're the bad guys in this particular scenario. I think that Trump was much more a reaction to the left than he was an embodiment of conservatism. That has its upside. It also has its downside. I think that the upside is that you actually have a reaction to the left. The downside to that is that people mistake anti-left for conservative, and these are not the same thing. Just because you oppose the left, or just because, more importantly, the left opposes you, does not mean that you're actually promulgating conservative ideas. I think that holds true for Trump. I think that holds true for Milo. I think that holds true for a lot of people the right has sort of embraced as reactionary forces to battle the left without examining whether these people are actually promulgating conservative ideas or even have read the Constitution.
So I was reading through you did a Reddit AMA the other day, mm-hmm. and I was reading through some of that, and you and I actually have something interesting in common in that in 2011, you
aside
and I...
Aside from the beard.
Yeah. You and I were both actually fans of Donald Trump in 2011 in a certain way, and mm-hmm. in that he was independent and he could run. Go back a year ago, and I actually worked for Kasich, and you were not a Trump fan.
No.
And so now, what do you think of his first 100 days, and how do you reconcile all of this?
So what I keep saying about Trump's first 100 days and about his administration so far is that Trump does not have any thoroughgoing worldview other than himself. He's an egotist. He likes applause. Sometimes that leads him to good things. Sometimes that leads him to bad things. So what I see is a guy who's sort of picking issues off the tree. If he leaves his administrators in charge, Sessions, Pruitt at EPA, if he leaves Mattis to do what Mattis does at defense, those people tend to do their jobs. When Trump sticks his thumb in the pie, things get all bollocked up because Trump really does not have any expertise on policy. He doesn't even know what he's talking about. The most powerful person in America, the most powerful Steve in America today is not Steve Bannon. The most powerful Steve in America today is Steve Doocy. Right, because what Trump does, he watches Fox and Friends, and then he reacts to whatever is on Fox and Friends, and that becomes his reaction to the day's news, and that drives the cycle. So that means that sometimes that's good, and sometimes that's bad. And so what I keep saying to folks is it's sort of like viewing a Seurat painting up close. If you're really close to the painting, it just looks like a bunch of dots, and you know, you pull out, and then you see that there's actually a design to this. We're too close right now, so it's hard to tell whether this is a bunch of dots that eventually is going to look like Sunday in the Park with George, or whether we're going to pull out eventually and it's just my baby's vomit. I just don't know. So it's a little bit all over the place. I think that I agree with 70% of what he does. I disagree with probably 70% of what he says. And I think that the first 100 days is a really stupid measurement just generally. But what it does tend to do is give you an indicator of what the vision the president has for the country looks like. So Ronald Reagan spent the first 100 days of his administration pushing tax cuts, pushing for smaller government. And even though he didn't pass any legislation, he set the groundwork. And he spent the first 100 days campaigning along those lines. Bill Clinton actually had a really chaotic first 100 days, but he set the groundwork for the idea that that chaos was actually going to lead him to shift to the right, because he wasn't effective. And so he had to move to the right and to the center in order to govern well. Trump, I don't know. He never had a worldview. He doesn't really have a vision for what the country should be. Make America Great Again is a great slogan, but it doesn't really explain what he sees as the future for the country. In fact, I wrote a column that will be out in a couple days talking about, there's this idea that we're now living in Trump's America. I really don't think that's the case. I think that we're living in the reaction to Obama's America still. I think that Obama sort of set the groundwork, and now Trump is still living within that framework. He's just sort of reversed the polarization a little bit. So Obama was very divisive. He had particular groups that he decided he was going to drive to the polls. He wasn't going to care about unifying Americans so much. He came about and said, you know, Americans can be unified by this big government ideology that is embodied in me because I'm the great uniter. And then he spent the next 8 years basically dividing people for political gain. And I think that Trump is living in that same framework. He's just reversed it. So I'm going to benefit particular political groups in Wisconsin, Pennsylvania, Ohio, Michigan. And I'm not going to benefit particular groups that Obama wanted to benefit, but I generally agree with Obama's basic concept, which is that a bigger government is possible for us to unify under the auspices of a bigger government through, for example, a $1 trillion stimulus package. We all like bridges. Bridges are great, right? And I think that doesn't bode particularly well for the future of conservatism in his administration, but it all depends on who has his ear. If he's out there campaigning in Pennsylvania and he's doing more speeches in Pennsylvania, whoever cheers the loudest is the person he will resonate to. If Jared and Ivanka have his ear and they're cheering him really loudly, then he will resonate to them. My basic working theory of Trumpism right now is that Trump has a knee-jerk reaction to something that he sees on the news, and then whoever cheers him the loudest becomes his top advisor for the next foreseeable point in time, and then he sees something else that happens in the news. He has a knee-jerk reaction to that. Whoever cheers him the loudest becomes his next political advisor. This explains Bannon. This explains Jared and Ivanka, and we'll see how it plays out as time goes on. This is the problem with having a guy who does not have any real philosophy of government.
So I'm going to take advantage of having this opportunity to ask you questions and get some free business advice out of you. So I primarily run campaigns here in the Bay Area. In the Bay Area, there are 28 elected legislators on the state and federal level. Of the 28, one is Republican. Catherine Baker. So how do we win elections 10 miles outside of San Francisco as Republicans?
Again, I think that libertarianism is probably the best way to campaign in California. I think it is generally, but I think that's the best way to campaign. I also have to say, I said this to Neil Kashkari when he was running for governor over and over and over and over. Why aren't you running on crime? Right, you see that Trump ran on crime and it really helped him. You see, the only time Republicans win in blue areas is when they win on law and order, safety issues. Rudy Giuliani wins in New York because of safety issues. Richard Reardon wins in Los Angeles because of safety issues. California has a spiking crime rate because Jerry Brown has decided to redefine crime down and release a bunch of prisoners into the general population and not fund any of the prison system. And quality of life is declining. It's declining in every major city. It's declining in LA. It's declining in San Francisco. You're seeing an uptick of people on the streets because there's been a decline in funding for mental health services in the state of California. He's run this state as a disaster, and I don't think that it's out of bounds to say if you want a cleaner city, if you want a safer city, then you ought to elect people like Republicans because what you're doing clearly is not working so far. I think law and order, here's the bottom line. What the statistics tend to show is that overall in the United States, men tend to vote Republican, women tend to vote Democrat. That shifts when you talk about safety issues. This is why in 2004, security moms won George Bush the presidency for his second term. And the same thing is true in major cities. People resonate to the safety issue. And it's something like every time a Republican says, I'm going to run as the education candidate, it's like, what are you, stupid? It's so stupid because it makes for an easy Democratic pitch. Okay, you want to spend X amount of dollars? I want to spend X plus 10 amount of dollars on education. But you actually have the benefit of that same logic with regard to public safety because whatever Democrat says they want to spend on the police, you say, I want to spend X plus 100 on the police, and you can actually win that particular debate.
You know, it's actually interesting you bring that up. So I was reading headlines today. Are you familiar with the BART system out here? Mm-hmm. And there was a mob of a mob of kids or teenagers boarded a BART train and actually robbed the BART train. And this was really reminiscent of me like the Wow Wow, as you see, you know, like, you know, people ride up.
Yeah, and taking Pelham 1-2-3.
Yeah, I mean, so, you know, how do you take that and turn it into a campaign, and how do you turn votes? I mean, so you want to run for a BART director in Oakland as a Republican with things like that going on. How do you get granular and really get, you know, votes on the local level?
Well, again, I think that one of the things that Republicans have to assume is that it's going to be a long-term uphill battle. This is not something where you shift it overnight. This is going to be you speaking the truth over and over and over and over without fear or favor. And I think that the idea that Republicans have, which is that they're going to go soft pedal this to particular audiences, that you have to soft pedal to the black community, law enforcement, I think it's insulting to the black community. Mm-hmm. I think that if you go in there and you say to black folks, well, you know, the reality is that the cops are out to get you, and like Rand Paul has done in certain contexts, and we really have to come up with a better way of doing things. Here is the reality of the situation. Every single community in the United States with a high crime rate has had problems with the police. Mm-hmm. Right now, the black community in the United States has a disproportionately high crime rate. That means that the police are going to have more problems in those areas, and that is not due necessarily to racism. It is due to the fact that when you bring the crime rate down, there's less areas of conflict. There are just less reasons for friction. And so what you need actually to protect innocent people is you need more law enforcement in these areas. You don't need less law enforcement in these areas. This is why I think the Black Lives Matter movement has done such a tremendous disservice to people who are living in inner cities. When you say take the cops out of the inner cities, the people who suffer are not who benefit are not the law-abiding. The people who suffer are the law-abiding. Those are the people who actually need people there enforcing the law. And I think that, you know, that may be a hard message for people to swallow. But again, I think that in a republic, you have to assume that if you speak truth often enough, eventually somebody will hear you.
So last local elected question. I think you'll like this one the most. So I know campaigning here in the Bay Area, one of the biggest obstacles we get in convincing moderate and Democrat voters to vote Republican is that they usually come out and say either, yeah, I really like everything you think about, you know, fiscal issues, but I can't get over the fact you're anti-gay marriage or you hate trans or, you know, you don't believe in climate change and all those things. So how do you overcome those issues with those voters who it's not like a one issue voter, but it's a barrier issue?
Yeah. Well, I think that the libertarianism, I keep saying the word, yeah. but I think that's really the best way to approach this stuff. I mean, the fact is that I think that it is ridiculous. I think it is ridiculous that society has decided, for example, that men can be women and women can be men. I just think there's no scientific basis for that whatsoever. But do whatever the hell you want. I don't care. I mean, like, it's your business. You don't do whatever you want. Do whatever you want. Like, this idea that I'm discriminating against you because, you know, I am calling you by your biological sex. You know, you don't have a right to tell me what to say. So that's it. So you do what you want, get whatever treatment you feel like, wear whatever you want, be you, I don't care. But, you know, this idea that you get to tell me what to do or say, that's silly, because I'm not telling you what to do or say. As far as same-sex marriage, my perspective on this has been clear for many years. I've always felt, that long before they legalized same-sex marriage in the state of California, I said that same-sex marriage should not be a government issue. I thought the government should be completely out of the issue of marriage completely, mainly because the government sucks at things, and also because from a conservative point of view, I also think that the government approving particular types of marriage is going to provide a club for particular political groups to beat down on churches. So the next thing is going to be, okay, same-sex marriage has now been approved by the state of California. 501c3 groups, churches, that don't wish to perform same-sex marriage are now going to have their 501c3 status removed because they're discriminating against gay couples. That's the next step. So the solution to this is not to allow that discrimination against religious people and religious institutions to take place. The best step after that is to ensure that the state just gets out of it completely. And, you know, I feel the same way about marijuana, even though I have never smoked pot and I find people who smoke pot irritating. It's not my business, right? It's not the government's business either. So I think that the government getting out of all of these things is actually a good pitch because, again, I'm leaving you alone. I think it's actually a winning campaign now with Trump in office because the left hates Trump so much that they keep thinking, oh, my God, we created this massive machine, and now someone we desperately hate is in charge of it. Like, hey, welcome to the last 8 years, gang. You know, but it's... But the best solution to that is, okay, you don't like Trump. I didn't like Obama. Guess what? We can make all of these people not matter to our lives. All we have to do is just make the government not that big. And then I don't care what Trump does, and I don't care what Obama does, and they'll just be egotists who live in big cities and bother, you know, whoever will listen to them at the bar. And this is the biggest problem. You know, the fact is that when the government is big, who is in charge matters. When the government is small, you don't have to care.
So I'll let you have your Marco Rubio moment. there's a lot of college students in the club or in the audience, and I think, or even younger, or people that have graduated but still young, and even some college Republicans here. You know, not everybody could become a nationally syndicated columnist at 17. What advice do you have for younger people that are wanting to get started in their career or conservatives on campus? Mm-hmm. You know, how do they make the most of their lives?
So I'll give you the same advice Andrew Breitbart gave to a lot of people. If you have a cell phone, that's a camera, you're now a journalist. So it is your job to go out there and find information that no one else is privy to, particularly if you're on campus. That stuff has widespread public appeal. If you see a story, send it to me at Daily Wire, and we'll put it up. I mean, we'll cover it. And if you want to write, write. You know, you're going to have to write for free. At the beginning, everyone does. I did. And then eventually you move from sort of reporting news to your perspective actually being interesting because you can infuse your opinion into the news in a way that's interesting. And then people want to hear what you have to say. Everybody thinks they're going to be Charles Krauthammer, but everybody sort of has to start off as John Stossel. You all have to start off reporting things. And then you can move into an area where people actually care about what you have to say if you're lucky. But everyone has an opinion, and your opinion doesn't matter more than anybody else's until you're bringing information to people that they've never heard before.
So, completely changed subjects. Biggest threat to America right now, and why?
I think the biggest threat to America is tribalism. I think that tribalism has broken out on the left and the right. People don't seem to care about the truth anymore. They seem to care about whether it helps my side or helps your side. And that is really, really dangerous because then we can no longer have a conversation. If we can't agree on a common basis of fact, we can't have a conversation in the first place. If you're just going to assume that I'm evil on the basis of my political perspective, then we can't have a conversation. And I'm seeing it both on the right and the left, which is troubling to me because I always thought that this was sort of an endemic to the left. I didn't think it was endemic to the right. I think that Obama has sort of trolled the right into oblivion, and the right now has become reactionary in response. And so it's, okay, so Trump said something that's not true, but he really screwed with the left's head, didn't he? And so, well, so what? I mean, that's not hard. It's the easiest thing in the world is to screw with the left's head. I mean, that's really not difficult. And on the left, the same sort of thing. You'll see the left say that Trump has proposed a Muslim ban. No, he didn't propose a Muslim ban. On the right, you'll see that people say Trump actually had a bigger inauguration crowd size than Obama, right? A plurality of Republicans believe that by polls. That's silly. Okay, it's not true. And just because you like Trump doesn't make it true. And this basic philosophy, I think, is really dangerous for the Republic as a whole.
What do you think about the whole fake news thing? There's actually a bill in California now where they actually want to create a curriculum in high schools to educate students on what fake news is.
Okay, well, I mean, first of all, the high schools in California should be the last people to teach people. I think that the idea that there are high schools in California may be fake news, but that's but it's, you know, the problem with fake news is mostly that people don't use it to mean actual fake news. Fake news is when you repeat it, when you have a story that is legitimately false, right? When you put a story out there that Pizzagate is fake news, right? There's no evidence to support it. The idea that they're running some sort of child whorehouse out of a pizza shop in the middle of D.C., no evidence to back that. That's fake news. It is not fake news to say that Donald Trump is doing better than his detractors suppose, but people will say that's fake news. It is not fake news, by the way, for the polls to report what the polls reported and then get it wrong. That wasn't fake news either. The polls just got it wrong. So I think that on both sides there's been a conflation between no news I don't like and fake news, and that's not the same thing. And so this is why I think that the label has lost pretty much all value.
So, North Korea, are we headed to World War III or the status quo of the last 20 years?
I would say more likely the status quo of the last 20 years. I don't think that Kim Jong-un really wants us to wipe him off the map. And that's sort of the next step, right? There's, thanks to Bill Clinton, we have an unpalatable situation there, but I'm not sure that it's going to go anywhere. I mean, the fact is that we don't have the wherewithal from as much as I can see. We don't have the wherewithal to actually take out the Kim family. We don't have the wherewithal to take out all of the artillery that's now lined up against Seoul at one shot. So that means that he's got 20,000 pieces of ordnance that are pointed at Seoul, which puts several million people in direct danger of death if we should do anything about this. The smartest move that Kim Jong-un ever made, or his father, Kim Jong-il, ever made, was to develop nuclear weapons, because now it's basically impossible to get rid of him unless we put significant pressure on the Chinese to replace him with somebody else. And the thing the Chinese want less even than the thing that they are most fearful of is the reunification of the Korean Peninsula. That, of course, is what they are most afraid of. So they'd rather have a crazy person in charge of that country that they at least have some semblance of control over than a reunified, democratic, and free Korea, which is tragic, but I think that status quo is basically as good as it's going to get, you know, barring some sort of exigent circumstance.
So what do you think what's going on in France? I think Le Pen and just the whole... Where do you think that's going?
I mean, I think Le Pen's going to lose. I mean, I think that it's you know, the fact is that anybody who is trying to compare that to Brexit or compare it to Trump... All of those polls were within 2 points, 3 points. These polls are not close. These polls are 26 points out. Now, could I be wrong? Of course I could be wrong. I was wrong about the last election cycle. But again, I would say that the margin of error is not 26 points in France. And pretty much everyone is unified against Le Pen. She made the move to disassociate from National Front today in a vain attempt to make people forget that she actually is a member of the National Front. I don't think that that's going to work particularly well. But it is obviously... And it is indicative of a great split that is happening in the Western world now between what's weird about what Trump said in this election cycle is he basically ran a European-style far-right campaign in America, and it worked. Whenever he says globalist, he's not actually talking about globalism. When he talks about free trade is not globalist, okay? The UN is a global institution. That's globalist. The EU is globalist. You have a regulatory agency somewhere that's dictating to you what you can do. Le Pen is running that against an actual globalist, right? Macron is actually a globalist. He's somebody who believes in the EU. He's somebody who believes that international institutions should cram down rules on the French, and he's winning there. The Trump was doing this on the basis of, like, he doesn't like NAFTA. That's not globalism. That's a free trade agreement we signed with some other countries. But it does demonstrate that there is a real backlash to the feeling that national interests are being sold down the river, and I think that is common to Europe. I think it's common to the United States. I think that the likening of Le Pen to Trump is a little bit strong for my taste. I don't think that they're as much alike as people say they are. But I do think that there is a broader anger at the idea that people no longer take their national interests to heart and that they are willing to put the national interest secondary to their own priorities. And that I do think is common.
So we got a stack of audience questions, and I'm going to start going through some of these. And you all have an opportunity later to actually come and ask your own questions as well. First one is, I actually think, a very important question. If you had a lightsaber, what color would it be?
Well, I mean, the good part of me would like to say green, but it'd have to be red, right? I mean,
I actually noticed you were wearing a Star Wars backpack.
Oh, yeah, the Rogue One backpack. Yeah, my sister got that for me for my birthday. Great movie.
Well, then what do you think of Episode 8? Are you excited for that?
I mean, the trailer looks awful. I'll be honest with you. I thought episode 7 was dramatically overrated. I thought Force Awakens. First of all, don't ruin my childhood. They ruined my childhood. I grew up on the Star Wars films. Spoiler alert, okay? They ruin your childhood. So that's it. Rogue One was, I thought, better than Force Awakens.
So this is actually from the same person. How can you have a law to not follow the law, i.e. sanctuary cities?
Well, I mean, you can do that on a federalist basis in the sense that you can't commandeer a local law enforcement agency to enforce federal law. But, you know, the federal government obviously has the capacity to cut off funding for your city, and that's what Trump is considering doing. So this is, on a federalist level, I appreciate the idea of a local government telling the feds to screw themselves. They're just doing it on the wrong topic.
You are listening to the Commonwealth Club of California. Listen to thousands of our podcasts on iTunes or Google Play. And when you're in the Bay Area, please join us live for one of our 450 programs each year. You can find us online at commonwealthclub.org. And now, back to our program.
So this person started with, love you, Ben, so I had to start with that.
Thanks, sweetheart.
Do you have any advice on how to talk to people who are so convinced you're a bad person just because of your political beliefs? I believe this is a very present issue here in the Bay Area.
Yeah, I mean, my typical opener with them is stop being an asshole. the reason that I say that is because the left's arguments are largely based on the idea of an unearned moral superiority, not that their policies are better, you are a bad person, therefore you must not be listened to, and you have to rip that unearned moral superiority away from them. It turns out that calling somebody a bad person without evidence makes you kind of an asshole. So once we've established that we can sit here and call each other assholes all day, then maybe we can actually get down to the content of the argument. But that has to be put out of the way first, for sure.
All right, this is more serious. Who is more of an existential threat to the Jewish state, liberal Ashkenazi Jews or Hezbollah?
Well, I mean, as far as an existential threat to the Jewish state, okay, so obviously the greatest threat to the death of Jews right now is Hezbollah. As far as the existential threat to the Jewish state, I wouldn't say liberal Ashkenazi Jews. I'm not sure what ethnicity has to do with it, but I would say that Jews of the left are certainly a greater threat to the Jewish state than any temporary terrorist group, because Israel is a very powerful country. It can survive onslaughts from terrorist groups. It could destroy Hezbollah if it so chose. But it's the same question, basically, as whether the American left is more of a threat to the future of the country than Islamic terrorism. And the answer, in my view, is yes. That doesn't mean that the American left is more of a threat to the life and limb of Americans today than Islamic terrorism. Of course not. But the future of a country rests on the solidity of its ideological underpinnings. And as those underpinnings are cut away, you end up losing the character of the country, and that's how you lose a country.
What are your favorite news sources?
So I don't go really by news source. I go by individuals. So I don't think CNN, for example, is like, I don't go by brands. So I think that I think Jake Tapper is good. I think Brett Baer on Fox is good. I think that there's reporters at the New York Times. So I think Maggie Haberman is actually a pretty good reporter. I think that there's people at various outlets that I like, and there are people at various outlets that I don't like. But you have to sort of be aware of who these folks are. I think Rosie Gray at The Atlantic is a good reporter. I think that there are a bunch of good reporters all over the country in various outlets, but people tend to do the stupid thing, which is, I saw it on Fox News. It's true. I saw it on CNN. CNN is fake news, right? And this is and it's just not accurate. I mean, like, sometimes people on Fox News say stupid crap, and sometimes people on CNN say stupid crap. And I will say I'm irritated by the constant use of the fact-checking chyrons on CNN after 8 years of swallowing direct tripe from President Obama. On the way in, I was watching CNN, God help me, and I was on a plane, so I couldn't walk out. So, it was, but they were running the chyrons, and then in parentheses, like, this isn't true. It's like, where were you when Barack Obama was saying, if you like your doctor, you can keep your doctor? It's really, that stuff is really irritating, for sure.
So I don't know if you actually said this, but we're going to find out. You have compared socialism to rape and capitalism to consensual sex. Why is a proud socialist like Bernie Sanders still so popular?
So, yes, I did, in a figurative sense, of course. So the idea was that taking people's property and taking their livelihood and their labor without their consent, if you were going to make a sexual comparison, would be more akin to rape. And capitalism is more akin to consensual sex, where both parties are hopefully enjoying a mutual exchange of benefits. But you know, why is Bernie Sanders so popular? Because his baseline is to say things aren't fair, and then everybody goes, yeah, things aren't fair, and then he has no solution for that other than to say things aren't fair. And people on the right go, well, yeah, I mean, we know things aren't fair. What you gonna do about it? Well, that's less of a sell. Right? What people really want to hear is that my opinion that things aren't fair really matters. It really matters deeply. So the other day I got in trouble on Twitter because Bernie Sanders tweeted something out about how if you work 40 hours minimum wage in every major city in America, you can't afford a one-bedroom apartment. And I tweeted out, right, that's why we have studio apartments, and that's why we need to, and that's why we have roommates, and that's why we need to, and that's why we need to, you know, aspire to things more than working minimum wage, and this is why you need to, and this is why we need to relieve a lot of the housing rules and regulations that prevent building of additional units, right? I mean, like, these would actually be solutions to the problem that he is suggesting, but this is unpopular. It's much more popular to just say, the world is unfair. Give me power. And unfortunately, I feel like this is kind of crossed the spectrum. So the way Sanders is about every economic issue is the way that Trump is about free trade, right? So Trump, instead of looking, he'll say, if you just give me total power, I will bring the jobs back to Wisconsin and Michigan and Pennsylvania. And it's like, no, dude, you won't. Okay, you won't. I'm sorry. Like, this idea that you're going to reverse technology, which has taken 85% of the manufacturing jobs in the United States that have been lost due to manufacturing. The idea that you're going to roll that back, what are you going to do, break the machines? Is that really what is good for the United States? And then when he says that he's going to impose tariffs, okay, so who else's job is going to be lost because you decided that there was a swing population that you needed to support? I thought that the bravest thing in this election cycle was Ted Cruz saying in Iowa that he was not going to stand up for ethanol subsidies and then winning the state, right? But nobody will do that because there is a draw to the idea that I'm from the government and I'm here to help, even though the truth is that none of us have ever really experienced the government being there to help in any real way other than taking your freedom at the same time.
So on your podcast on Friday, you had a whole rant about Neil deGrasse's video. Mm-hmm. I'm going to give you an opportunity to kind of talk about that and that whole perspective on what he's doing and that argument.
So Neil deGrasse Tyson is basically turning science into religion. And this is something I dislike. Science is science, and it's wonderful, and I love science. And I actually agree with Neil deGrasse Tyson about, for example, he thinks that creationism shouldn't be taught in science class. I tend to agree with that. But I also understand that it is not my job to tell parents how they want to educate their children. And if they so choose to vote for a local school that is going to educate their children a particular way, that is well within their purview. They are the parents. I am not. Neil deGrasse Tyson thinks we should all live in this place called Rationalia, where he is the king of Rationalia, and then he dictates to everybody what they should be taught and what their values are. He also has this bizarre idea, which has been super dangerous throughout the last century and a half, which is that science dictates morality. Science most certainly does not dictate morality. Science can tell you what is factual and what is not factual, but science cannot tell you what to do with any of that stuff. The fact is that there have been plenty of regimes in the course of human history that have said they are scientific regimes and then have proceeded to engage in the most horrific human rights abuses in the history of mankind. And so this idea that the march for science is going to make things better because yay science? No, yes, yay science. Science is great. Love it. Awesome. But it is not going to tell us what solutions ought to be undertaken on a political level because there's a morality that comes into play. So let's even assume everything that Neil deGrasse Tyson believes about global warming is true. Let's take the IPCC estimates that by the end of the century, the water levels will have risen, the ocean levels will have risen 2 feet, and 7 degrees Fahrenheit will have been added to the temperature. Let's assume all of that is true, put aside all the uncertainty, put aside all the variability, put aside all the computer model, put aside all that stuff, and let's just assume that that's true, which is quite possible. Okay, so let's assume all that's true. Does that dictate any of the solutions that he's proposing? Or is it possible that maybe we'd be better off, I don't know, building more nuclear power plants, right, which have fewer, less carbon emissions? Would it be better to encourage natural gas drilling because natural gas is healthier for the environment than coal, for example? Presumably, he wouldn't like any of these things. But if you say that those would be your solutions, he would immediately say that you're a climate change denier, even though you actually agree with him on the science. And this is the problem with this March for Science and Neil deGrasse Tyson stuff, this idea that science will inevitably lead us all to the same conclusions in terms of public policy. There is no basis to support any of that. Science does not lead you to the same conclusions. If it did, everybody would be pro-life. Okay, so the fact is that... One of the great irritants about the March for Life is the same people who are saying that that people are anti-science for not believing deeply enough in global warming that they want to have a massive confiscation of wealth across the world. Those same people are saying that that science says men can become women. No, gang. No. So science is science, and morality is morality, and sometimes there's crossover, but not always.
So that's actually a good lead into my next question, audience question. You are the keynote speaker for the 2017 National Right to Life Convention. Recently, DNC Chair Tom Perez said that there was no place in the Democratic Party for pro-life Democrats. Should pro-life Democrats become Republicans?
Yeah, for sure. Of course. I mean, I don't know why pro-life Democrats haven't become Republican beforehand. It seems like a pretty major issue to me whether or not you are okay with the killing of the unborn. So, yes. Yes, and good for Tom Perez. I'm glad that he's made his party's stance on this clear. I mean, I knew this back in 2012 when they were openly cheering abortion at the 2012 DNC. I mean, I was there, and I saw, you know, people. I saw guys walking around wearing buttons that said, "I love pro-choice girls." Yeah, I can imagine why you love pro-choice girls, dude.
Switch gears a little bit. In particular, raising minimum wage. Or so, how do you argue with someone who's an advocate of, let's say, the $15 minimum wage? Yeah. What's the counter there?
I mean, number one, you're pulling that number directly from your ass. I mean, I said this to Shama Sawant. So Shama Sawant was the creator of the $15 minimum wage in Seattle. And I debated her. We did a debate probably 2 years ago on this particular topic. And I asked her, you think that these companies are socking away money in their Scrooge McDuck money bins and swimming in it at night and all this stuff. And so, you know, you're a socialist. She's a self-declared socialist. Why $15? Why? Really? I mean, to live in the city of Seattle, it's like $23 an hour if you actually want to live in the city of Seattle. And why not go higher than that? I mean, obviously, it's these rich people who are screwing these poor people. So why not go $1,000 an hour? Right? And then everybody can work like 1 hour and everything's great. So why not just do $1,000 an hour? And she said, and she sort of deferred the question. And I said, I will co-sponsor with you a resolution to put this on the ballot in Seattle, because I think that it would be great to find out whether the socialists in Seattle are willing to destroy every business in the city of Seattle. Because that's the truth. They will destroy every business. The fact is, very few people are on the federally mandated minimum wage at that level. But the jobs that people are doing for minimum wage exist at minimum wage because that is the value of the job. I'm sorry to break it to folks, but if your job involves you, and this is not to degrade the value of work or the fact that you have a job, but if your job requires a functioning prefrontal cortex and a radial bone, like you're flipping burgers and that's all you do, don't expect to make lawyer dollars. Okay, that's just the way the market works. And that's a good thing, because you wouldn't want your hamburger to cost $56, unless it's a fantastic hamburger. So this idea that minimum wage throws people out of jobs, it leads to loss of employment, it perverts the market, and it helps the people who are earning the minimum wage, but everybody else who gets fired ends up on the unemployment rolls.
So you love to debate. I was actually advised not to debate you from some of my friends. So who has been your favorite person to debate?
I always enjoy the conversation. So there are a few debates that I thought, I mean, you know, there are ones that are obvious that come to mind. Piers Morgan was fun. not for him.
Why don't you talk about that, actually? why don't you actually talk about that? Because I actually enjoy that story.
Yeah, I mean, so Piers Morgan asked me, he asked me on his show because I wrote a column where I said that he'd gone off the rails on gun control. It's because after the Sandy Hook shootings, he had decided that every night on his program, he was just going to say that anyone who didn't want full-scale gun control was an evil person who didn't care about dead kids. And so I knew when I went on his show, he had Alex Jones on, I think, the night before or two nights before. And so he hadn't really looked me up. So he sort of assumed I was an Alex Jones type. I am not. Although I can unbutton my shirt and scream in a very loud voice for male vitality, vitamins and such. But I went on. So I go on his show, and I only knew I was going to do two things, and one was the lead-off. I knew that before he had a chance to categorize me as an evil, horrible conservative who didn't care about dead kids, he said, "Why am I, you know, Mr. Shapiro, why am I off the rails?" And I said, "Well, Piers, it's because you stand on the bodies of the graves of the kids at Sandy Hook to push your political agenda." And you could see he was basically, he said, "How dare you?" And I said, "Well, you do. I watch your show." And he sort of clutched at his pearls and then said, "How dare you?" And I said, "Well, you can keep saying that, but it's true. I watch your show." And he was basically on the defensive from then on because I had used the tactic that I explained to you before. He meant to castigate me for my character. And when I said to him, "You can't castigate me for my character just because we disagree politically," he had no place to go from there. And the other thing I had planned is I obviously had brought a copy of the Constitution to give to him, which was fun. So that was a particularly fun. He was pissed. I mean, he was not happy. Went to break, and I was like, "Thanks for having me on, Piers." And he was like, so he was really, really unhappy. So that was a fun one. I did a debate with some really nice people. There's one from the NAACP up in Seattle, and a couple of columnists for the Seattle Stranger, and a couple of other folks about Black Lives Matter that I thought was a really fun debate. I debated Sally Cohn at Politicon, which I thought was an interesting and fun debate. I love debating because, for me, it's just an opportunity to clarify views. And sometimes people say things, and it's clarifying for me, and that's great. I mean, if you can clarify something for me, go for it. I appreciate it.
So a couple things. One, I know you have a flight to catch, so we're going to go into the Q&A section. And this is my first time actually being a moderator, so I kind of actually missed the queue. I was supposed to announce it 5 minutes ago. But yeah. So we need to be very orderly. There is a microphone in the back. And so if you'd like to ask Ben or me a question, please head to the back. And then once we're done with the Q&A, we'll talk a little bit more. But please remain seated to let Ben make his flight back. So head that over to Marissa back there.
Oh, and I'd appreciate, this is my general rule for all Q&A sessions. If you disagree with me on something, raise your hand, and then you can go to the front of the line, if you don't mind.
And
if people disagree and they raise their hand, they can go to the front of the line, because it's more fun to talk with people who disagree.
Also, these are questions, not policy statements and declarations and manifestos. So, you know, make sure your sentence ends with a question mark, and it's a sentence, not a paragraph. Yeah.
Hey, Ben, how's it going?
It's going well. How are you?
We good? So my dad came from Soviet Russia. He lives in California now. He's been here for 20 to 30 years. He's a former spy. So his take on the Russia situation is really interesting. I was just curious, outcome-wise, where you saw the situation headed, especially as it pertains to Syria. It's really complicated, confusing area and situation. And then... Or you could choose this question. Who's your favorite political commentator? Actually, looking up Thomas Sowell led me to you. So
yeah,
he's really high on my list.
Yeah, so Sowell's fantastic. I've said many times that if I could pick, anybody in the United States to be president, I'd pick Sowell. I love Sowell. So as far as the first question about the Russia situation, I thought that you were saying Russian spies. I thought we were going to go to Trump, Russia. So I'll give you my opinion on both, even though you didn't ask it. So the first on Syria... I don't know that Trump actually has a thoroughgoing foreign policy there. We don't know yet. It could have been that he just saw some dead kids in Syria and decided I'm going to shoot a camel in the ass. And it's basically like Trump, it's basically like Obama, rather Clinton, after the attacks on our embassies in Kenya and Tanzania, and he's just going to shoot a missile in the middle of nowhere and hit something. So I don't know that he actually has a policy in Syria yet. We will see if something emerges. That is really unclear to me. And he has a base that is not happy with him for engaging in Syria in the first place. So it could be that it's a show of strength and there's nothing to back it up. It could be that there's something more thorough going. But it's a mess. And it seems to me that the best available policy would be to set up a no-fly zone, to create refugee camps that we help fund so that people don't have to travel over to the United States and be taken in here, and that we encourage Muslim countries around the world to take in more of their brethren from Syria. Turkey has taken in many. Jordan has taken in many. I don't see why Indonesia shouldn't take in some. So that's sort of the answer on that one. As far as Trump and Russia, my feeling on that is that probably what happened is that Trump Trump didn't know what he was doing in this campaign. So I think what happened is that Trump basically... he had to go to B players, and a bunch of people were probably saying, who's great, this Paul Manafort guy. And he was like, sounds good to me. And so he hired Paul Manafort, and Manafort was connected to the Russians. When that became evident to Trump, then he had to let Manafort go as it became clear that Manafort was under investigation. Trump probably had no real relations with the Russians, but he was afraid that Manafort's relations with the Russians would be pinned on him. And that's probably the extent of it, if there was any sort of relationship at all. I don't think it goes all the way up to Trump, because I don't think Trump is capable of that. And as far as the love that Trump has shown for Putin, I think that's more just Trump-like strength. It's just, and so anybody who's strong, Trump sort of likes, right? I mean, he'll say warm things about Saddam Hussein because Saddam Hussein was quote unquote strong. So that I think falls by the wayside as soon as Putin decides not to do what Trump wants.
I want to point out really quick that you're in a room of about a couple hundred people in San Francisco, and no one raised their hand that they don't want to argue with you.
So there's every conservative in San Francisco. Yeah. In one room. Don't tell Antifa; it could get dangerous. They'll wipe us all out at a shot.
Okay, my friend has a daughter going to public school in San Jose, elementary school. He was recently told by the administration that he's not allowed to tell his daughter that she is a girl because she has to decide for herself. What should he personally do? And is there anything we can do in the communities to combat this institute?
She's an elementary school, a public elementary school?
Elementary or middle school, yeah.
Okay, so, I mean, I would withdraw my kid from that school forthwith.
Okay.
I mean, and if I couldn't do it, I'd look for family to help me pay for it. I would get my kid out of that school as fast as possible.
Yeah.
I mean, by studies, 70 to 80% of all kids who have gender confusion grow out of it by the time they hit their teenage years, and purposefully fostering gender confusion in small children is evil. It is evil, okay? You should not be fostering gender confusion in small children. It is one thing if the kid already has gender confusion, then, you know, you have to try and clarify for children why gender exists and why sex exists, more importantly. But this idea that schools have, that they are going to confuse 100% of children about sex in order to make things nice for the this tiny, tiny percentage of kids who are experiencing gender dysphoria, it's cruel to kids who would not be confused otherwise. And, I mean, just on a statistical basis, not to be callous, and I don't think it's callous, I think it's actually helpful. On a statistical basis, the transgender suicide rate is somewhere in the neighborhood of 40% over the course of lifetime. If you are saying that there's one kid in a class of 100, right, who's suffering from transgenderism, suffering from gender dysphoria, gender identity disorder, and now you're going to tell all 100 kids that they are free to choose whatever gender they choose. They can be a boy, they can be a girl, and they're little kids. They don't understand what the hell they're talking about. Kids are stupid, okay? I have two of them under the age of four. They're dumb. Okay? I love my kids. They are smart. Whenever somebody says my kid is super smart, they mean for their age. Okay, my 3.5-year-old is brilliant for her age. She can't read. If she's at the same level of intelligence when she's 30, she will be dumb, right? So this idea that kids are capable of just making their way by themselves, this kind of Rousseau notion that we throw them out into an open field somewhere, and then they educate themselves, is stupidity of the highest order. Even Rousseau was shocked when people told him that people were bringing their kids up like a meal, right? Even Rousseau was like, this is stupid. What are you doing? It was a fiction book. So this is really... But to take it back to the statistical level, let's assume that now 10 of those 100 kids have gender confusion. So you took 9 kids who wouldn't have gender confusion, you now give them gender confusion. Let's assume 2 of those kids end up experiencing significant gender confusion over the course of their lives. You've now taken a situation where 1 kid had gender confusion and will have presumably a 40% suicide rate over the course of that kid's lifetime. And you've taken that now, you've tripled it to 3 kids on the basis of what you've just done. Okay, that is nasty. Your job as a parent is to clarify the world, not to confuse the world for a small child.
Ben, you generally have a, have a governmental philosophy of libertarianism, personal mm-hmm. choice, non-restriction on the governmental level. As a libertarian, I find one of the most problematic parts of that philosophy is when it comes to drugs, which can you see drugs like heroin and meth that just wreak havoc on any communities they're exposed to. Mm-hmm. What is your position on the general libertarian idea of we should make all drugs legal for everyone, and what kind of effects do you think that could have?
So I think that the general libertarian ideal of legalization of drugs is not a bad one, other than there are certain drugs that actually have externalities. So the general libertarian John Stuart Mill idea is that you pass a law when there are externalities to a human action. Right, I can swing my fist around until it hits you in the nose. Well, PCP is a case where I would not legalize PCP because PCP actually makes you violent. Right, there are certain drugs that actually make you violent and more likely to hurt somebody. The reason that I'm not in favor of marijuana legislation is because we have DUI laws. Right, we have laws against engaging in violence. I don't think government is capable of saving people from themselves. I don't. And I think that the only what we actually need, and this is why I say there needs to be a conservative libertarian merger, is because the only way you can have a libertarian perspective on drugs that are so damaging to entire communities like heroin and cocaine, the only way you can have a libertarian perspective on something like that is to have a functioning, flourishing social structure that encourages people not to engage in that sort of thing and that rewards people for not engaging in that sort of thing and punishes people for engaging in that sort of thing. And so we need to have, I'm not sure that immediate legalization of all drugs is a panacea. I don't think it just solves everything. But I do think that what you could have is a transitional program where we rebuild social structure by encouraging people to join in community programs again, engage with their neighbors a little bit more. The number one predictor of drug use, I believe, statistically, is still single motherhood. So, you know, the idea that you're going to be isolated in a community with a single mom and you have family problems and then you're going to turn to drugs, that's a better predictor than poverty alone. So, you know, I think that we need to restore that social structure, but this is the bargain. Libertarians have to acknowledge we need a social structure The problem with libertarianism is the sort of cultural libertarianism that suggests that it's not bad to do heroin. It is bad to do heroin, but the government can't stop it. Right, so that I think is a distinction worth making.
Thanks, Ben.
I'm actually going to pull one of these ladies up so that we can mix it up a little bit.
Hello, my name's Elizabeth. I'm the vice president of the University of San Francisco College of Publicans. I, like many of my friends... are outspoken about our beliefs, and I recently heard that George Soros, a very wealthy American-Hungarian businessman, is in charge of funding people like BAM and Antifa, and I was wondering like what we can do to mitigate these results of these bums who don't have anything else to do but come and protest our Milo Yiannopoulos events.
So, you know, as I've said, I think that if the police are not going to do their job defending people, then unfortunately self-defense falls to the personal realm. So, you know, there have been a lot of people who've gotten a lot of flack for showing up at these rallies and defending people like Milo. I'm not a Milo fan, as everybody who's followed me knows, but that doesn't matter. His speech is free, and it deserves protection. So, you know, that if the police won't do it, then obviously citizens are going to have to. But in the end, I think that you know, there are going to have to be measures that are taken by the local population to vote out people, or you're going to have chaos in the streets, and that's what you're saying, chaos in the streets. I'm not sure there's a better solution than that, unfortunately.
Thank you.
Hey, Ben, I love your podcast. So if someone believes that abortion is morally wrong and that life begins at exception, but they also think it should be safe, legal, and rare because they think people will do it anyways and hurt themselves, what would you say that to that person in order to convince them that it should just be illegal?
Okay, so it should be illegal because if you believe that it is wrong, the reason presumably you believe it is wrong is because you are harming another human life. That's the only reason to believe it's wrong. There's no other reason to believe abortion is wrong other than there is an externality, you're harming someone else. Right? If no one cares about you having your tonsils removed, no one cares about you having a polyp removed. But we do care about you killing a baby because it's not you. So that being the case, I have a stake in the government enforcing laws that prevent murder. And if you believe that killing a baby is, if not murder, then at best manslaughter, then you should be in favor of the government regulating it. The idea of safe, legal, and rare was always nonsensical. If it's not bad, if you believe it should be legal, then I don't see... Well, if you believe that it's bad, then you should believe in this particular case... Again, that it's a human being harmed, and that's not you, and so it should be regulated. Safe, legal, and rare is a formulation that makes no sense in this context. It's like saying murder should be safe, legal, and rare. You can't. It just doesn't work. I mean, how do you have murder safe, legal, and rare?
Thanks.
Hey, Ben. I've been following your work for some time. I'm curious to listen to your thoughts on the issues on the campus that we've been having seem to be related to, for every one conservative professor, there are like 50 or 40 liberal professors.
Yeah.
So how do you equalize that ratio?
So the one of the big problems with the way that professors are made, and people who are PhD candidates know this, is that basically it's like the old Soviet judicial system where people appointed their successors. So PhD candidates have to go through these lefty professors in order to get their PhD. And that means you're not going to be writing your dissertation on the value of everybody owning a gun anytime soon. So what actually has to happen is the market-based solution in the end, which is alum have to stop giving money to these universities. They have to punish people with their checkbook. They have to instead redirect those dollars toward startup universities, toward Hillsdale College, toward Liberty University, toward universities that actually, King's College, you know, universities that actually have a stake, CCU, Colorado Christian University, universities that actually have a stake in teaching values. And when you direct your money that way, then I think that that'll be better. I think the other way to do this is to just break the back of the colleges entirely. You could actually do this pretty easily and quickly if it weren't illegal to give IQ tests for employment. Really, I mean, colleges are just a giant filter system that run up an enormous debt to show that you are committed enough to actually do a job, and the SAT is a very basic IQ test. That's all the SAT or the ACT is. They made it illegal to do that because they felt it was discriminatory, because the outcome was not racially equal. But if people would just hire high-achieving students out of high school, and this is what Peter Thiel has said for a long time, then I think that that would actually be worthwhile. I don't understand what your four-year degree from Berkeley in lesbian dance theory is going to do for you. If I know you got a 1500 on the SATs and had straight A's in high school, I'd probably be willing to hire you without the degree in lesbian dance theory.
Hi, Ben. Thank you for being here today. I just had a question. I had a conversation with one of my friends recently who's African-American, and he told me that he's afraid every day he goes home that he's going to get shot by the police just for walking on the street. Mm-hmm. And I told him, well, statistically speaking, you're much more likely to be shot by another black person than you are by the police. And he told me, who's running these statistics and what kind of interest do they have? How would you respond to someone who essentially doubts your facts?
I would use facts from the local government, which is being run by Democrats. I'd use facts from the FBI and the DOJ. I mean, where is he getting his stats? Like, this is one of these things that I hate, is this general idea of you're denying my truth. There's no such thing as your truth. Okay, there's your opinion. And you may have had an experience that is really bad, and that's terrible, but that does not generalize out to the population at large. I mean, the fact is that not only is a black person much more likely to be killed by a black person than by a cop, a white cop is 19 times more likely to be shot and killed by a black person than a black person is likely to be killed by a cop. So this idea that you are, you know, that black people are victims of some sort of genocide by the cops, it's just not true. And there's a whole political group in the United States that makes a lot of hay off of this by ripping on the police and then promising they're somehow going to solve the violence problem by avoiding the real cause of the violence problem, which is people who are committing crimes. It's really, again, I don't know how to argue with somebody who denies facts. At a certain point, you just have to cut off the argument. But the facts are the facts, and we should not put them aside just for sensitivity's sake.
Hey, Ben, thank you for coming. It's great to have a pro-life speaker here at the Commonwealth Club. I know they hosted Cecile Richards recently, so it's nice to have a good contrast. I am the president of Pro-Life Future of San Francisco. But I'm also an atheist, I'm a feminist, and I'm a registered Democrat. And I really appreciate what you were
talking... I was with you all the way until the registered Democrat.
I really appreciate what you were saying about tribalism and how that's kind of destroying the political system. And I was hoping that you could elaborate a little bit more on that and maybe perhaps... Since I'm someone who's always had a foot in kind of both camps, I've worked in the pro-life movement for a very long time... is there anything that you see coming from the Democratic side that you actually do agree with, that you think that they got right and maybe the Republicans got wrong?
So I think that the Democrats were right as a general matter on the idea the government should get out of people's sex lives. So I think that that's an area where I think that the Democrats were right. I think that we're in a world beyond that, unfortunately. I think that... You know, obviously, in the 1960s, with civil rights, there were some Democrats who were right, and then there were Southern Democrats who were deeply, deeply wrong. It was Southern Democrats who were pushing segregation. You know, as far as what the Democrats are currently pushing now, the Democratic Party has moved radically to the left. So I don't see a lot from them that I appreciate in terms of policy per se, and that's too bad because I think that there are, you know, real public debates that should be had on the way the government is run, but we have to get beyond the calling each other names before we can actually do that. So if a Democrat wants to propose a solution, then I'm willing to listen and consider. So but they'd actually have to do that, and that's hard to come by usually.
Thank you.
We have time for two more questions.
Hey, Ben.
No cheating, guys. No cheating.
You're obviously a proponent of small government, and you've mentioned earlier this evening that there is obviously a danger when you have a divisive president with so much power given the size of the government. I'm wondering if you see a problem with the current Republican consensus that our undeniably large military spending is justified and the military-industrial complex isn't something to pay any attention to.
So I think that obviously you have to look for waste and abuse in the military. I mean, you don't want golden toilet seats. But it is my view that the government has one basic function, and that is to protect our lives and our liberty. And so on the foreign policy sphere, this really comes down to, do you think that an active America on the global sphere is more likely to defend your life or liberty than a smaller military? So I don't think that it's actually a question of the size of the government. It's a question of, because now we're talking about a situation where even libertarians acknowledge that the government has a function in protecting your life. It's just that there are a lot of isolationist libertarians who think that the government shouldn't be as interventionist in foreign policy. So I'm not one of those people. So this isn't a libertarian big government versus small government issue anymore. Now it's an issue of how do you think foreign policy should best be conducted in order to protect life and limb. I'm somebody who believes that it is foolhardy to cut the military in the expectation that our enemies are not going to fill the gap and then foster terrorism and foster threats to our allies and national security and threaten trade and threaten all these things that we actually have an interest in. Isolationism may have been a viable policy in 1810, but as 9/11 demonstrates, Bill Clinton was actually kind of an isolationist in many ways, and we ended up with 9/11. We do this periodically, the United States. I mean, in the 1930s, we cut our military so that by the time of World War II, we had the 19th biggest military on the planet, about the size of the Philippines military. And then we obviously had to ramp up in favor in order for World War II to happen. You saw this with Jimmy Carter cutting the military before Ronald Reagan had to build it up in order to face down the Soviet threat. You saw it with Bill Clinton before George W. Bush had to face it, had to ramp it up to face the Islamic terror threat. You see with Barack Obama, where he ramped down the military and immediately China and Russia began filling the gap. I just don't think that there's this weird idea in sort of the Ron Paul right that if we just butt out of the world, that the world will butt out of our business. And that just, I don't see why that's true. And I don't see any evidence to support that.
And this will be our final question. Thanks to everybody who stood in line.
All right. Hi, Ben. Thanks for coming. So I would like to ask, would you help to spread the news of David Dalyden's arraignment on May 3rd here in San Francisco?
Yeah, absolutely.
So that we can all show up in support of him and the preborn.
100%. If you could do me a favor and email me, my email address for everyone who cares is bshapiro@dailywire.com. If you can email me about that, we will definitely cover that and we will definitely push it because it is a tremendous miscarriage of justice. I mean, the idea that the state of California is looking to prosecute, for people who don't know, this is the guy who made the Planned Parenthood videos, that they're looking to prosecute him in violation, in violation of law. I mean, I've done the legal analysis of this particular case. There's good case law from the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals that basically says that he was doing something newsworthy, and therefore it's what he was doing was not a violation of privacy rights. There's no privacy rights in the areas in which he was filming and all this. The fact that the state of California is attempting to prosecute him is a political prosecution and a political persecution, pure and simple. And unfortunately, that may become more common in the state of California. So if people can show up and protest, I think that'd be definitely worthwhile. Happy to help, for sure. For sure.
There you go. All right, we have one final question, and it's actually a tradition here at Inforum to ask all of our speakers the following question. What is your 60-second idea to change the world? Let's hear it.
My 60-second idea to change the world is fix your own problems. Okay, solve your own problems. I don't have an idea. Here's the thing. I don't have an idea to fix the world because I'm not God. Okay, I'm not capable of fixing the world for you. You are capable of fixing your own world because no one cares about you. Okay, I'm not standing in your way. No one else is standing in your way. If they are standing in your way, then it's our job to get them out of your way if they are forcibly stopping you from exercising your rights. But here's my idea of fixing the world is to get everyone the hell out of your way so that you can succeed on your own because no one cares about your success as much as you do and no one cares about your failure. Okay, so it may seem like a simplistic solution, but it's the only one that has ever helped anyone in the history of humanity is you helping you, not the government or some disembodied, you know, big leader helping you. Only you will help you. If we all took that to mind, solve your own problems. I think it's a good slogan going forward.
All right. It says, let's give a big round of applause, but I think you guys just did that, you know.
Thank you.
Yeah. So, well, now they're giving a standing ovation. So thank you very much for coming, Ben. It was a pleasure.
Thank you so much. I appreciate it.
If everybody, hold on. Can everybody please stay seated? Please stay seated. He's got a flight to catch. You have to have some selfie restraint. so thank you, Ben. It was a pleasure.
Sorry about that, guys.
So thank you.